At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson. Transgenderism. It's one of those topics that most of us would rather not talk about, but it's considered a valid life choice today, and it's going mainstream. Joining us on the program and helping us to understand this issue better is Andrew Walker. He is a professor at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's also the author of the book called God and the Transgender Debate. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Richard, it's so good to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Andrew, you wrote that book, and I was just going over some notes. You wrote that book the year that CPC did a series of conferences across the state called Loving My LGBT Neighbors Without Losing My Convictions. And I actually just, there's a YouTube video of you out there presenting. It was in Bowling Green. You had started out by sharing that evening, within minutes of you speaking, you had learned of the first transgender individual getting elected to public office. It was a state house member in the state of Virginia. Is it fair to say since then, that was just 5 years ago, is transgenderism becoming more mainstream and more acceptable?
Yeah, Richard, that's a really good question. I think that there's no simple answer to that, and you could answer yes and no in various ways. I think we could say, on the one hand, it might be becoming more mainstream simply because we have a cowardly media network, we have a cowardly political institutions. Particularly, I'm thinking here of the federal government, where, you know, if they sense that their base wants this far left ideology to be mainstream, well, then they're going to bend themselves and conform themselves to those kind of constituent demands. So I think that this is kind of one of those things where the emperor has no clothes, though. It presents with the illusion of cultural power and political power. But when you begin to kind of peel back the layers, what you tend to have is that the emperor, again, has no clothes. And the reason I can say that is when you begin to see the number of secular, non-Christian voices, even atheist voices, who are beginning to raise concerns and doubts about the pace of the transgender movement, but also the philosophical coherence of the movement, what you're beginning to see is chips in the secular foundation beginning to take place. You can think of individuals like Douglas Murray. You can think of individuals like Bill Maher, individuals such as Barry Weiss, all three of those individuals, non-Christians. And they're beginning to recognize that the pace of this movement is going too fast, and it's potentially doing damage to young persons in the name of political tolerance and political correctness. And, you know, I honestly, I've been studying this issue now for close to 6 years or so. And I think we actually had a major breakthrough in the situation involving the swimmer Leah Thomas. I don't know Leah Thomas's male name, so I'll just refer to him as Leah. When Leah Thomas was blowing female competition out of the water, the NCAA finals, you had secular commentators kind of raising eyebrows at this. That, is it fair for males to compete against females? Because that really does kind of overturn our understandings of basic fairness and justice and equality. And then we had the picture of Leah Thomas on the podium as number one, broad-shouldered, obviously biological male. And then you had the second and third place finishers way off on the picture, actually positioning themselves kind of off camera, because you could tell that they thought this was a sham as well. that they had been robbed of their, you know, being first and second rather than second and third. And so, you know, honestly, I just think that this movement is exhausting itself faster than the coherence of it can try to play catch up. Yeah. And so, you know, at one point I was saying in 50 years, I think the trans movement is going to be more or less over. I've kind of moved that forward, the needle forward, to think that I think in 10 years, I think we're going to see some major regressions of the movement. And I think we're going to see that particularly when medical malpractice lawsuits begin to proliferate from people who transitioned and then recognized that transitioning did not resolve the underlying psychological distress in their life. And they had their bodies maimed and surgically altered, and you can't go back to those previously pre-operated on bodies. And so I honestly think, you know, always when you look at mainstream culture, you're always defeated and you feel depressed because of this kind of unquestioned political correctness, get on the train or else the train's going to run over you type of mentality. But here's the reality. I think that if you talk to people on the ground, this is running afoul of natural law so abrasively that people with basic consciences and common sense are recognizing, hey, is this really sustainable? And I think we're beginning to see some serious pause in the mainstream celebration and acceptance of this.
So, Andrew, that's good. I think one of the questions we need to ask is, how do we get to this point in history where it does become acceptable for a person to identify as the opposite sex and then to hormonally and surgically transition to that sex, and further to allow children to do it? There are, you know, in Kentucky, we have worked on a bill here at the Commonwealth Policy Center to restrict minor children from undergoing untested hormonal therapy or surgical permanent scarring surgical procedures that, as you mentioned, you can't go back on. We've had a hard time getting that through. Now, some states have. I think there are a handful of states that have prevented that. How do we get to this point? And that's what people are asking. Is this, I mean, the post result of postmodernism or the result of being in a post-truth culture where objective reality and facts are trumped by strong emotional feelings? Are these some of the things that have contributed to this moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, as a kind of a philosopher and ethicist of ideas, it's not traceable to simply one thing. Monocausal explanations are rarely ever satisfactory. It's a whole conglomeration of things. If you're asking me to kind of give the shortest historical survey of how we got here, sure. You can look at ideas as far back as the 13th century that began to deny the existence of universals. It's a philosophical school called nominalism. And then you can get to individuals like David Hume, who argues that there isn't really objective morality. All morality is an expression of emotional satisfaction or emotional dissatisfaction, which means there is no, again, objective morality. It's all a matter of the internal subjective self's happiness or unhappiness in response to external stimuli. Then you get to individuals like Darwin and kind of natural selection and evolution, which purports to give explanations of the world's existence and its origins apart from God, which more or less kind of weaponizes those kind of prerequisite ideas where there are no universals, there are no such things as objective morality. And now with Darwin, you can get there is no God. Well, when you don't have God, you basically license any number of explosive potentials for moral to fill those moral vacuums. And so now we're living downstream roughly 300 years or 200 years from kind of the scientific explosion where the world thought we could explain the world on purely naturalistic terms. While the world thinks it might be able to do that, what we're learning is it can't attempt to do that apart from human wreckage happening as a result. Whether you want to count that as the cost to families, the cost to children. There's been tremendous human collateral as a result of rejecting a transcendent understanding of the world. And I think that might be, if there is one single answer, I think it is rejecting that enchanted, transcendent understanding of the world, that you as a person are not accountable in your body or in your understanding of morality to anything else other than your conscience, your feelings, your desires. So that gets us to today, where we have phrases that are now more or less stock phrases, like you do you, live your truth, live your authentic self. Those phrases come about because of an underlying relativism in our worldview, the thinking that morality is collapsed down to the individual, that the individual and their horizon is all that matters as far as what morality is concerned. And then obviously all of this acts to displace a Christian ethic. And it's not, I mean, nature abhors a vacuum. Something is going to fill the vacuum of morality. It's a question of whose morality. And here we just have a secular morality attempting, I think unsuccessfully, to replace a Christian understanding of morality. But then you have philosophical ideas also to explain here, with what we call Gnosticism, or what we might call a body-self dualism. This idea that the body is something different from one's consciousness or one's perception of themselves. And interestingly enough, Gnosticism is something the church has fought for 2,000 years, because the church has always taught that we are a body-soul unity, that God doesn't just redeem souls, he redeems bodies in the fullness of time. So that in the Christian theological framework, matter actually matters. Creation matters. Jesus is resurrected bodily, not just spiritually. And I think that's how we understand ultimately why the body matters, because God resurrects the body. But as far as else how we get here, right now we're living in an age of self-autonomy and expressive individualism. And from that, you create kind of new, what I call blasphemy codes, blasphemies against the gods of this age. And the gods of this age is the self. You know, we are now having this conversation post-Roe, which we didn't think, it's hard to believe that this is actually real. One of the things that we're seeing in the aftermath of the Dobbs decision is people are objecting to the idea that your body has moral significance, and how you use your body actually has an objective moral consequence sewn into it. And if you're told, don't use your body in a way that you want to use your body, that is to commit blasphemy against the gods of this age. But hopefully that gives us kind of a broad overview.
No, it gives us a lot to consider, and yet mainstream culture has embraced this idea that it is a good and valid choice, even for children to, at 2, 3, 4 years old, to who say, I really am of the opposite sex, for us to support that. I listen to NPR. That might be a confession to some of the listeners here, but I get my news when I'm in the car traveling. They have been doing a story, ongoing story, about Texas and their law that will prosecute, go after parents who are allowing their children to undergo gender transition surgeries or procedures. And when NPR covers a story, they talk about Texas banning gender-affirming care. They'll interview the parents who say it's scary when the state is imposing its values. It's just, it's fascinating listening to that, Andrew. The terminology, of course, whoever defined the terms, you win the debate.
Think about the language. It used to be called sex reassignment surgery by activists, but activists no longer want to recognize the legitimate, concrete existence of biological sex, either perhaps at all, or if they want to acknowledge it, they don't acknowledge its authority. So that the surgery now becomes gender confirmation surgery. Notice the linguistic shift right there. Notice the linguistic shift around how we define the experience of individuals who have gender identity conflicts. It used to be called gender identity disorder. Disorder has a negative connotation attached to it. We now call it gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria sounds much more like a condition, and a, you know, like depression like something that's not morally calibrated or morally considered. It's just a medical issue. So we went from stigma to non-stigma. And I actually would expect in the coming years for activists to remove dysphoria from the language as well, because dysphoria sounds as though that there's still something non-normative about having a gender identity conflict.
That's right.
I think we're now, what we're moving towards, you know, you want to celebrate the idea that someone has a gender identity different than their biological sex.
Besides news reports, seeing it in, hearing it in music, TV programming, one of the, an Emmy award-winning show is called RuPaul's Drag Race. RuPaul was interviewed by Time Magazine in 2017, and he was asked, what's the purpose of drag? And he said, it's this, to remind people to not take themselves too seriously. We mock identity. A lot of people get angry. Identity is not to be taken seriously. We show people we are shapeshifters. We are God in drag. That's our role, is to remind people of that. How is a Christian processing this issue from a biblical worldview? How should we think through what he's saying there? And on one hand, he sounds contradictory in some aspects, but it got my attention, Andrew, when he said, we are God in drag. I mean, that sounds blasphemous in itself. What's going on with RuPaul? I mean, it's a popular show. He's won Emmys. He's front and center. He's very visible in our culture. And there are young people watching this. I read a comment the other day from a young person who got involved with the LGBT lifestyle because he watched RuPaul when he was a teenager. How should we think through a comment like that?
At the most basic level, you know, I'm gonna bring this back to Genesis 1 and 2, because ultimately this isn't just peculiar to drag and trans individuals or trans-identified individuals. This is speaking to a more subterranean reality confronting every single human being, and that is the question of, I mean, it's a twofold issue. One, everyone is searching for an identity. That's what everyone's after. But in Scripture, we're warned that if we don't embrace the limits that God has placed upon us as His image bearers, what are we going to do? We're going to view ourselves as though we are our own gods, as though we have the ability to define what is right and wrong, rather than acknowledging what is right and wrong underneath the canopy of God's sovereignty and His goodness to us. And so I think in these situations, it's twofold. You have individuals who are trying to find an identity that suits them. And to find the identity that they think suits them, it means for them casting off the created limits of this world and trying to engage in novelty, sexual exhibitionism, trying to create ever new plastic ways to concoct an identity at variance or at odds with the natural limitations of having, of God having made us male and female. And the futility of this whole movement is, no matter how much you try to transcend your bodily limitations, you can't do it. You can surgically alter your body. You can ingest your body with hormones. And guess what? The most surgically altered male who wants to live as a female is always going to be biologically male, because you cannot change the underlying software of our nature. You can't change the genes. You might be able to try to rearrange the exterior. You might try to rearrange the hardware. You can't undo the software. And so I think a biblical worldview around this is to accept the givenness of our bodies, to accept the givenness of the world that we live in, and try as best as we can to live in accordance with it, knowing that we do live in a fallen world. Fallenness affects all of us. But the answer to fallenness is not to live further and further in opposition to created order. It's to try our best to live in accordance with it, even when we fall short of it, knowing that we're all in need of God's grace. But fundamentally, this is about identity seeking. And I know of no better place to nest one's identity than in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Male and female, He created them in His image. That image is final, it's authoritative, it's objective, and you can't bypass it, even despite your best attempts to do so.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Andrew Walker of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I'm Richard Nelson. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that the news media isn't always fair. In fact, there's lots of far-left bias and political gamesmanship. No surprise there. So if you're looking for a perspective that's grounded in the truth of Scripture and our nation's founding principles, then get plugged into CPC's resources. Sign up for our e-newsletter at CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Commonwealth Policy Center, and we're on Twitter at CPC4Kentucky. Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Andrew Walker, and we are talking about transgenderism and identity. Andrew, just before the break, you were talking in my language, biblical terms. You're approaching a very difficult issue from a biblical worldview. We're talking about created in the image of God. We're talking about sin, talking about identity. You mentioned Genesis 1, 26 through 28. What do you say to the person who says, I don't believe that? I'm not a Christian. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in the Bible. How do you respond to that?
So, I mean, that's what we get into a branch of ethics called natural law ethics. And natural law ethics is merely a way of saying that Christian ethics actually describe the world accurately. And so natural law is helping us take the truths of Scripture and to translate those into categories that individuals who may not agree with us about Scripture can still be confronted with the truths of rationality that we can learn from basic observations of the world around us. And so a natural law argument around this issue would be to say this. Males and females, to define what a male and female is, you have to define maleness and femaleness by the body's organization for acts of reproduction. Mm-hmm. And if you attempt to define maleness and femaleness apart from the body, that's where you get to this proliferating and ever expansive understanding of gender identity as something that's distinct from the body, which is why on Facebook you can have 60 plus gender identities. And what I would say to the person who doesn't agree with me on Scripture, I would say that's fine. You don't have to agree with me on Scripture. But let me ask you a question. Do you think that it was fair for a biological male to compete against a biological female and to blow that person out of the water regarding competition? I think someone who isn't a Christian would have to acknowledge a basic concept like fairness and to say, you know, that you're right. That does seem to be a little bit imbalanced. And here's why, at the end of the day, someone may not want to acknowledge their belief in God. I think Scripture has a category for that. It's called suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. I think some people might be confused. Some people want to rebel. Some people just want to suppress. But I think if you get people being honest with themselves and honest with you, outside the confines of political correctness, outside the confines of a poll, and you're having a conversation one-on-one, and you're able to say to that person, do you think it's right for someone to have to compete against someone who doesn't bear the same physical characteristics? And I think if that person says, oh, it doesn't really matter, then I think that person is operating on the grounds of very, very shaky reason. It's irrational. It's incoherent. And the best of the Christian natural law tradition is here to tell us that the truths of faith correspond to the evidences of reason. And so we actually have better answers. I mean, one of the things I love to say most, we are not the weird ones for believing that men are men and women are women. It should be the burden of trans activists and their allies to argue why it is and to justify why it is that a man who says he's a woman is actually a woman. That goes against so much history. It goes against so much philosophy. It goes against basically all sound reason, in my opinion, that the burden ought to be on them to justify that claim.
What advice would you give to parents whose children are struggling with gender dysphoria?
The biggest advice I would have is to not act as though you need to immediately move into transition-related categories. I mean, A, I don't recommend transition for anyone at all as a blanket principle, but we know from studies that it's not necessarily uncommon for children to have gender identity conflicts because they're young, they're learning their place in the world, they're trying to learn what the norms around their particular sex are. And we know that upwards of 90% of children who report having some gender identity conflict, again, that number was 90%, they tend to, over time, resolve themselves naturally and without intervention. And I'm just thinking now, what on earth is our insane culture doing to these children who, were they left to their own devices and not swayed by ever-shifting ideology and political correctness, would resolve naturally? And this is, Richard, why one of the reasons I'm optimistic amidst the tragedy of the movement. I'm optimistic that we're turning a corner in this conversation because we're beginning to see that there are serious victims left in the wake of this ideology. We have what are called detransitioners or desisters, whose narratives you can find on social media and on YouTube. They don't get any presentation on mainstream media. Of course they don't. Mm-hmm. And they're telling the world, we attempted to transition. It didn't bring about the hope and resolution that we thought it would. And now we are left to live in these bodies with the consequences that were done to these bodies. Again, what the church has to reckon with and what public policy has to reckon with. One of the first rules of public policy, by the way, Richard, is to do no harm. Legislators, let me advocate to you that you not do harm and to further ideology that is going to harm our children. To the church, that means we have to be prepared for the refugees of the sexual revolution, an ideology that was communicated to us under the pretense of erotic freedom. Sleep with whoever you want, identify however you want to identify, you do you, there are no consequences. Richard, we are learning in real time how unsustainable that is, yeah, and how many victims and negative consequences there are in its wake.
Andrew, that's good. I wish we could continue, but we are out of time. I will close with this. Andrew Walker will be joining us in Owensboro Christianity and Culture Conference. He will be giving a presentation on this topic. This is going to be Thursday, June the 30th. At the Owensboro Convention Center. Andrew, we're looking forward to you joining us there.